this story, you have this interesting moment where Jesus has come to the well for something to drink, and his disciples have gone on an errand. If you think of the early days of Jesus' ministry, he's traveling around with a group of 12 to 20 people. It's like a big youth mission trip for the first 3 years of the gospel. They're always going from place to place, and they're having to organize things. And while the Bible records all these amazing sermons that Jesus is giving, there's also all this behind-the-scenes work where they have to do things like figure out what is everybody going to eat. And that's one of the reasons that there are so many stories in the Bible about people eating, is they were traveling together and they had to figure out what they were going to do. And very much like your typical youth mission trip, they were on a budget. They did not have unlimited funds, and many times they were dependent on the kindness of strangers to welcome them. But in this case, Jesus has sent the disciples off to get some dinner. So they're on a food run. There, the disciples are at Costco or at Wendy's or something like that, Jimmy John's. But they forget to take Jesus' drink order. And he's thirsty. And it's noon. And he's in Samaria. And these are the enemies of the Jewish people. So Jesus goes to the well in the center of town. Now, in a dry and hot climate like this, the well was not like a drinking fountain that you could just get a drink from. It's a well. So how do you get water out of a well? You have to have the bucket that goes down, and then you have to have something to put the water in. And back then, the division of labor between the men and the women was very clear. And at this point in the story, the disciples are the men, and the women are often the ones on the food run or making things happen. But in this case, the disciples are over at Costco getting the food, and Jesus encounters this woman. Now, part of a woman's work back then was to get the water for the family. So they might put a jar on their head and carry it. This was very hard work. And go to the well and bring the water back maybe once a day. When would you want to do that in a hot climate? Not at noon, right? Probably early in the morning. And that was when most women would go to the well, and they would go to the well with a group of women, and they would do it together. It was probably a social thing, a morale-boosting thing when the work was hard. But for some reason, this Samaritan woman is at the well all by herself. Why? It's probably the case that the other women don't like her. Maybe she's been excluded. But she doesn't get to go with the other women. In fact, the only time she can go is the worst time of day. It is noon. So she's out there in the hot sun, and Jesus comes up to her, and he says, "Woman, will you get me a drink of water?" Now, this Samaritan woman doesn't know Jesus. Maybe she's heard of him. But she's of a different religion, and she comes up to him, and she says, "Why is it, Jesus, why do you ask me, a Samaritan woman, somebody you don't know in the middle of the day, somebody who is of a different religion and background, why do you ask me for a drink of water?" Or maybe she's just saying, "Why do you expect me to drop everything and get you a drink of water?" She could have just been tired. And Jesus goes on to have with her the deepest theological conversation he has had yet in the Gospel of John. So far, he has been recruiting disciples, but this time he goes deep, and he says to her, "I am about living water, and there's this other kind of water that quenches a spiritual thirst." And she says to him, "Where do you think people ought to worship? Do you think they ought to worship in Jerusalem?" And this is where this Samaritan woman reveals to us that she is in her own right a religious scholar who knows the differences between the religions. Because one of the reasons that there was this friction between the Samaritans and the Jews was that the Jewish people perceived that Samaritans, whose land had been overtaken by the Assyrians, were just willing to go with the other religions of their occupiers, and the Jewish people held firm to their customs. So they were at odds with each other. And part of the way the Jewish people held firm to the customs was the way they ate. Do you know what that's called? Keeping kosher, right? They didn't eat the same things as the occupiers of their country. They followed different customs, and the Jewish people of the day, while they had different tribes of Judaism, just like we have the EKD and the UCC and the Presbyterians and the Lutherans, they had their different tribes of Judaism, but at least they agreed they were separate and they weren't going to follow the gods of their oppressors, and they thought that the Samaritans had caved in. And so one thing they believed was that their temple in Jerusalem was a holy place. And the Samaritans did not believe that. But one of the things that Jesus is going to do as a Jewish teacher is he's going to challenge that idea that Jerusalem is the holy place. He is going to consistently give a message back then to the Jewish people that is a message that we really need to hear as the Christian church right now in this moment in time, that the church is not a particular building or a particular cathedral or even a particular moment in history, that his gospel is going to be wider than that. And so he says, not only am I not hung up about Jerusalem to this woman, he says, I am the Messiah who is coming. And he tells her this. And thus far, he has not told anybody else in the delegation anything at this level. But before all that happens, there's a very interesting conversation that every time I've ever heard this passage preached on, this was the part that the minister seemed to focus on. It's the conversation that Jesus has with this woman about her husbands. Do you remember that part of the story? It's a little weird. They're just sitting there talking, and he says something like, you know, go call your husband if you're not going to give me a drink of water. And she says, you know, I don't have a husband. And he says, in fact, I know that. He says, I know you've had 5 husbands. And she says, what of it, essentially? And he says, I happen to know that the man you're living with now is not your husband. That is often the piece of the story that everyone gets obsessed with. Oh, what does it mean this woman had 5 husbands, now she's got another one, and she's an adulteress, and she is outside the scope of respectability, and what does it mean that Jesus speaks to her, and oh, isn't that nice of Jesus that he speaks to her? But look how little that has to do with what he talks to her about. They have this little back and forth like that, and Jesus still has this deep conversation with her where he tells her something he hasn't told anybody else. He takes her seriously. And this is interesting. Do you notice what Jesus doesn't talk about? He doesn't say, well, now that you've admitted you've had 5 husbands and you're living with another, like, let's talk about that. And, you know, I don't mean to pry about the 5 husbands, but I do have to know, Barb, like, whose fault was it? You ever notice that? Anybody here gotten a divorce and had people ask you those awkward questions? You know, they say, oh, I'm so sorry to hear about your divorce. Are you doing okay? So what caused it? Did the other person do something wrong? Or did you? Are you the villain? Or please tell me, Barb, you're such a nice person, tell me you're the victim. Tell me you didn't do anything wrong. And it's like, I've been married 23 years, of course I did something wrong. Everybody has done something wrong in a marriage. We do something wrong every 3 days. Whose fault was it? But this is what we do as human beings. We want to categorize people. We want to say, well, you are the villain, you are the victim, you are good, you are bad. Well, if you were married 5 times, maybe all 5 of them were awful and you were right every time. Probably not, statistically speaking, but we do these mental gymnastics with people. And it's a subtle way of trying to figure out what category to put them in. And you notice Jesus doesn't do any of that. We don't know why this woman was married 5 times. Back then, by the way, in the culture, it was easy to get a divorce if you were a man. Not if you were a woman. But if you were a man, in the Jewish tradition, certainly all you had to do was write a letter saying, I'm divorced. Thank God they didn't have email back then. It would have been a lot higher. Think of every time you've written an angry note. But all you had to do was to write a letter. Women were considered property. They could be dismissed like that. Who knows if that's how she was treated? Why wasn't she married to the man she was with? Who knows? Maybe he didn't want to marry her. Maybe she did not want to marry him. And Jesus says, you know what? I've decided you are the person I'm going to tell that I'm the Messiah. I remember there was a bishop in the Methodist Church who I admired greatly, and I went through a difficult time in my life and my ministry, and I went to talk to him, and I said, oh, this has happened, and I messed up in this way, and I made this mistake, and I don't know if I want to be a minister again, and I don't know if anyone would want me, and I'm just so midlife crisis messed up. And he said, you know, Lillian, I'm pretty sure Jesus can work with all of that. The idea being that maybe it is in these things that we receive the wisdom to be the receptacle of the information that the Messiah has come. In this country, things that I think we took for granted about the status of women and how we would be treated are suddenly feeling like they are up for question. Battles that we fought for the dignity and respect of people in their sexuality, their right to be married 5 times if they want to be. The work we've done to protect the rights of trans people, the work we've done trying to understand pronouns, learning how to talk to people with respect, saying, if you have changed your name, I'm going to make an effort to understand that and to respect it. Because guess what? In the Bible, everybody is always getting a name change. In the Bible, everybody's in transition, friends. Everybody. Every time God comes into somebody's life, so often it's, you used to be Sarai, now you're Sarah. You used to be Abram, now you're Abraham. You used to be Paul, now you're Saul, now you're Paul. And today in the church, when we read the letters of Paul, nobody gets up there and says, oh, you know, it's so hard for me. I'm just always going to think of him as Saul. I just can't. Seems like we've worked so hard for these basic things that are basically human kindness and fairness, and then it feels like it's going backwards. And friends, I believe that the church is going to be the place where we embody a different ethic of kindness that may seem stranger and stranger in this country and more important. And this story is pivotal. Jesus picks the woman that even the other women who are put down even the other women despise so much that she has to go to the well at noon. And when they wrap this up, she goes off and becomes the first preacher in the Gospel of John. The first. When I went to visit the North Church in Pomerania, in Greifswald, I came with the burdens that we have in the American church, where we worry about, oh, it used to be this beautiful building over here, or it used to be this many people, or in the heyday it was like this. And it's like we are worshiping the temple in Jerusalem in our nostalgia. And I brought that with me. I was so excited to find out they don't have any of those problems in Germany. No, I mean, I thought, oh my goodness, the history in Germany. We went to the church for your installation service. How old was that church? 1200s maybe? It used to be a Catholic church. Then it was this, then it was that. These buildings had so much ancient history. We went to another church for the choir concert where we had South African a cappella choir who was singing. And this church was so old, it almost looked like ruins. It was so beautiful in the night. And that church, the members, they didn't speak that much English, and I'm embarrassed, I speak no German. And yet we stayed and we had fellowship and we had food and we stayed and talked for maybe 2 hours. How did we talk? It was try this and let me try to say that. And I remember some of the people from that church, they said, the word they used was, I'm ashamed that I cannot speak English. We didn't get to learn English during the communist dictatorship. These were the people whose churches were shut down and suppressed. And I was humbled by that. I was humbled by that, that these churches in that part of Germany, in the dictatorship, had gone through hardships that we in the American church cannot even imagine. And they were still there, worshiping God in beauty, inviting guests from South Africa, from Michigan, and a number of those people at that church remembered our Michigan people who had come there 20 years ago. They said, we sang in a choir together. We played the bells together. And I thought, there is no shame for you in not having been taught English. The shame is on me for not knowing more German. But ultimately, in Christ, there is no shame for any of us. There was no shame for the woman who had 5 husbands. There was no shame for her because of who she was with. There was no shame for her because she was alone at the well, working harder than everybody else, that her life had been hard, and it was to her that Jesus said, I am the Messiah. And while the men were at Costco, she became the first preacher and told everyone the good news. Amen.